Hello again. We're coming to you from the trenches. I'm Bree Hayden.
Not who he said he was, not, in fact, even a confidential informant working on behalf of law enforcement, but actually an undercover police officer. And that's very significant.
Coming up, we'll learn about a Chicago police officer who was recently exposed as an infiltrator of Chicago's progressive efforts.
And the challenge of the Internet, the promise of the Internet, was that it would be a force for egalitarian politics. It would be break up monopolies, and it would undermine militarism. I don't think there's much evidence it's done any of that stuff. And if it hasn't, then I don't see how it's such of a force for democracy.
And we'll hear from a media scholar, Robert McChesney, about his new book about the future of the Internet. The news website Truthout reported on May 21st that an undercover police officer posing as a street medic has infiltrated Chicago activist efforts in the past year. The infiltration included the anti-NATO actions of 2012 and actions in 2013 against Chicago public school closings. The revelation spurred outrage among Chicago activists, who are all too familiar with harassment from Chicago authorities. To learn more about the infiltration, its context, and its importance, we'll hear from one of the co-authors of the report, Chris Giovannis, who was interviewed by Chicago Indie Media's Mitchell Shapinchik on Friday, May 24th.
Chris Giovannis, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much for having me.
Briefly lay out the findings of what you report in the article.
Well, we looked at the antics of a medic, a new medic that had signed up for a training in March of 2012 with Chicago Action Medical, ostensibly to get involved in the volunteer group, which provides emergency first aid and health care to protesters at special events and so forth, broadly for Chicago's progressive community. And they initiated a series of very comprehensive trainings for new street medics and healthcare providers who wanted to provide that kind of service on the streets, particularly in the run-up to the NATO protests. So he first got involved with CAM through one of their trainings in early March, and then continued to be involved in their work until as recently as May Day, although fairly early on, some of the more experienced street medics in the collective started to have real concerns about this individual. You know, infiltration by confidential informants and even undercover police officers has always been a problem in progressive movement work in the United States. It dates back at least as far as the COINTELPRO project, which was run under the auspices of the FBI's J. Edgar Hoover, which was really a terror campaign against any progressive groups or individuals that didn't share Hoover's proto-fascist authoritarian view of how the country ought to be run and structured. But it, you know, COINTELPRO itself really is predated by a very long-standing war by the authorities against unions, against abolitionists fighting slavery, against people who were fleeing slavery themselves. It really goes back to the 1850s and the 1860s, and the founding of many police forces in the United States, which were originally created, among other things, very frequently to suppress struggles for labor rights and to capture and re-enslave runaway slaves. So this is a very long-standing pattern and practice by the political elites of our country to undercut those who are fighting for social and economic justice and equality in the United States. The concern that the medics had about this individual really surfaced very early on when he seemed to exhibit an inordinate interest in fishing around in a nonviolent healthcare project for inquiries about everything from Molotov cocktails to the potential for property damage. He also absolutely refused to follow CAM's guidelines in terms of how one works on the street. So they became very concerned that his real role was not to provide health care and assistance, particularly for people who might be injured in the course of a protest by law enforcement, but that his real intention was actually to make inquiries about and perhaps even to incite activity that might not be lawful or activity that was actually designed to compromise and undermine some of the progressive projects going into motion around the NATO protests. That was subsequently confirmed with his continued surfacing after NATO at the same time that a name of an individual began to surface in the court records of a number of criminal cases, collectively known as the NATO 5 cases, that have continued well after the NATO protests. These are 5 individuals that were charged with a varying degree of criminal charges, including for 3 of them charges under the state anti-terrorism statute. And as more information became available in the court record, it became clear that it might be possible to link this individual to, in fact, this at best sketchy individual that had sought to affiliate with CAM, with Chicago Action Medical. And it's really the combination of examining the court record as more information has become public, and then working directly with our sources in CAM to examine both the electronic and the physical contact that this individual has had with the group ongoing through at least May 1st, 2013, to try to really put together the pieces that could actually verify the growing suspicion of this individual's identity, namely that he was, in fact, not who he said he was, not, in fact, even a confidential informant working on behalf of law enforcement, but actually an undercover police officer. And that's very significant because that really begs the question then of why this undercover cop, who was posted to a task force that apparently had at least some interface with federal authorities and state authorities, in terms of surveillance, spying, infiltration in the run-up to NATO, why that individual was still in motion engaging in exactly that same kind of activity a year after the NATO protests had ended. Why, for example, did his targets include a rally in March of 2013 being organized by parents, students, and teachers to oppose the massive school closings that were just jammed down the public's throat in the last week? Why was he actually, a physical presence at a May Day 2013 rally for immigrant rights? What a rally that was legally permitted, that had, dotted all its I's and crossed all its T's in terms of its right to both rally and march. That really fits the pattern of COINTELPRO infiltration and the parallel activities that we saw in Chicago's local arm of COINTELPRO, Chicago Police Department Red Squad, which was officially disbanded for its egregious abuses of constitutional rights in the 1970s, but appears perhaps to be back in a pretty full-blown version today, even though there's an ample string of police spying abuses that date from the 1970s through recent years. It suggests that the Red Squad in Chicago has never really ceased operation, even though it operated under a consent decree for 20 years that banned this kind of illegal, unconstitutional, and highly questionable activity.
what advice would you give for activists or for everyday listeners with regards to this kind of infiltration or espionage? Is there anything that can be done or that should be seen, or what advice can you give?
Well, I think first and foremost, it's very important to be educated about patterns and practices of police surveillance and to understand what the real intent of that kind of surveillance is. There is a growing body of evidence that's been released by groups that include the Partnership for Civil Justice, for example, that are really starting to expose this national campaign that's coordinated with federal and local law enforcement agencies and other government agencies that's designed to surveil and, frankly, flat out undermine progressive movements for economic and social change. Probably the most prominent target of that has been the Occupy movement. So first and foremost, people need to really understand what this kind of infiltration is designed to do. It's not benign police monitoring of political groups to ensure that no laws are broken or that no misdeeds are committed. This is infiltration, surveillance, and in some cases, particularly in cases like the NATO 5, for example, where law enforcement in an undercover capacity actively sought to entice people into activity that could be charged as criminal activity, essentially creating crime in order to prosecute crime, and then use that as an opportunity to dirty up a larger movement. So education, first and foremost, is key. Secondly, there is a growing body of information, some of it dating back many decades, that still has much good insight into how to practice responsible security culture within your own organizations that will protect you from this kind of infiltration, and that even more importantly than infiltration will protect you from the kind of dirty tricks that these law enforcement surveillance operations have historically engaged in, targeting political endeavors which their overlords simply do not like and seek to undermine. So, you know, practice smart security culture, but also understand what the broader agenda of these kinds of undercover operations are really designed to do. They're really designed ultimately to surveil and, where possible, derail and undermine progressive movements for economic and social change.
That was Chris Giovannis, who was interviewed on May 24th. The report is available from the Truth Out website and featured on Chicago Indie Media's website at chicago.indiemedia.org. We're coming to you from the trenches. The Internet has played a critical role in transforming our political and media landscape. From galvanizing protests to upending the paradigms of journalism and broadcast media. But with all the changes the Internet has made, there's a great deal that the Internet has not changed. Powerful government and corporate forces remain powerful. Indeed, the biggest and most influential companies are now those connected with the Internet and technology. The goal is to lock in a permanent commercial and anti-democratic orientation to the Internet. It's the topic of a new book by University of Illinois professor Robert McChesney entitled Digital Disconnect: How Capitalism is Turning the Internet Against Democracy. We'll learn more about Professor McChesney's book and issues it raises in this interview with Chicago Indie Media's Mitchell Stupinczyk, recorded on Sunday, May 12th.
Bob McChesney, welcome to the show.
My pleasure, Mitch.
Give me a brief description in maybe a minute or so about what the book is about and why you wrote it.
Well, the title pretty much explains it, how capitalism is turning the Internet against democracy. You know, I've been pondering the Internet, studying it, teaching it, writing about it for two decades, really since the World Wide Web vaulted it to such overwhelming preeminence. And, you know, I've been planning to write a book on the Internet for a long time, but it was never the right time because it seemed like everything was still in formation. It was unclear where it was going. In the 90s, there was total confusion about how it was going to develop. Now, I think in the last few years, it's become increasingly clear that there are a handful of corporations or practices that have emerged online that have proven very lucrative, and that they are going to be here for the duration. 13 of the 30 largest companies in the United States, based on market value, are Internet-related companies. Most of them have monopolies online. They're not going anywhere. They're going to be here for a long time. They're going to have phenomenal political influence. For example, there are only two or three banks among the 30 largest firms. Those are the two big failed banks that basically tanked the economy and got bailed out and no one went to jail. And we've got four times as many Internet companies. So they're at the heart of the political economy. They're in existence. And they're not going away. So I think now's the time to sort of step back and say, okay, what exactly is going on here? And how does this relate to the promise of the Internet from 20 years ago, 15 years ago, that we still hear rhetorically that the Internet was going to enhance democratization? It was going to give people power to govern their lives. It was going to undermine tyranny and government secrecy. It was going to undermine monopoly and corporate bamboozling of people and increase competition. How do all those promises hold up? And my argument in the book is that capitalism has been largely a negative development in terms of the democratic potential of the Internet, and that we stand right now in the United States and worldwide anywhere between 5 and 10 major distinct policy issues that are in play. And these issues will go a long way toward determining, you know, what course the Internet goes on from here on out. Unless there's sustained public activism, the outcome of all of these will almost certainly be to the benefit of the dominant firms. But on each of these issues, there's tremendous popular opposition when people are aware of what's going on, and there's the potential for organizing. So the book is an effort to alert people to these issues, acquaint them with the issues, and get them motivated to act on these issues.
One thing I noticed actually right out from the get-go, in the subtitle of the book, you don't mince words. You mentioned the word, the C word, that has been so long a taboo in American popular discourse, even at a grassroots level, capitalism, and kind of equating, not too subtly, that capitalism and democracy are mutually exclusive. A lot of people will still take it as a kind of a given that they're the same, that, you know, capitalism is an expression of democracy. But yet you explain in the book, and in fact devote a whole chapter, that they're not. And I'd like you, if you could elaborate a little bit more on that, please. How is capitalism different from democracy?
Well, capitalism and democracy have two very different histories. Now, they're closely connected at certain points, which is why there's the confusion. But they have very different histories. Democracy goes back, well, at least to the ancient Greeks, 2,500 years ago, to Athens, with the revolutionary idea then that people without property ought to be entitled to have equal political power, men in that case, not just people. Men ought to have equal political power to those with property. Property should not determine how one's role as a citizen could be. That was a radical idea then. It still was a pretty radical idea. And the premise of democracy, if you thought about it long and hard, before capitalism, democracy was understood as basically a one-class society. It was understood that if you had genuine democracy, you couldn't have much economic inequality. You had to have a real commitment to a more egalitarian society. Otherwise, formal democracy would be a joke. Capitalism comes along far more recently. It develops in the last few hundred years and really crystallizes with the Industrial Revolution in the late 18th century and early 19th century. And capitalism has this sort of interesting relationship with democracy. There have been, of course, scores of capitalist economies that have not been democratic whatsoever. But at the same time, capitalism has increased the wealth of society overall. That's one of its great contributions, which has made it possible to have democratic societies where they didn't exist. So they do have a close relationship that way. But what I argue in the book is that on a handful of crucial areas today, what capitalism is doing is directly inimical to the achievement of democracy in any sort of meaningful sense, that they're really at loggerheads. And the areas I pointed out in the book, Mitch, are one, economic inequality. You know, democracy requires there not be a great deal of it. Capitalism, especially the real world capitalism in the United States, is generating massive amounts of inequality, and it's not going away. Secondly, democracy does not work well if there's monopolistic control over the economy. A more competitive, a more diverse economy, a more decentralized economy is better for having self-government, having democracy, because then power isn't concentrated. And under real-world capitalism, really existing capitalism, like we have in the United States, not like politicians talk about or economists talk about, we have a handful of corporations that totally dominate our economy. So that's a bad thing for democracy. That doesn't bode well. Third, the United States is a heavily militarized system country with $1 trillion a year spent on the military. And it's crucial to the way our capitalism works. It has been since the 40s. It's well understood by people in power that, you know, the military spending is the foundation of R&D, of development. And but militarism, like we have in the United States, with all these secret wars we're now having, with all the corruption that comes with it, all the cronyism, all the propaganda, all the spying, all this is very negative for effective self-government. And this is, none of these points I'm making are controversial. They're all made by political conservatives. Milton Friedman on monopoly, for example. And in terms of militarism, the greatest enemy of militarism is James Madison. I mean, that's why our Constitution tries to make it so hard for there to be a permanent military for the United States to go to war. Because Madison was a scholar of ancient Greece, of Rome. And he saw that the decline of Athenian democracy and of the Roman Republic was because they were empires. He famously said that no country could remain permanently at war and also be a democracy, that something would have to give. Now, the test for the Internet, in my view, and the challenge of the Internet, and the promise of the Internet, was in each of those three areas, it would be a force for egalitarian politics. It would be break up monopolies, and it would undermine militarism. And if you look at the record and what I discussed in the book, I don't think there's much evidence it's done any of that stuff. And if it hasn't, then I don't see how it's much of a force for democracy.
I'd like to explore a little bit more one of those foundations that you describe with regards to the intersection of capitalism and democracy, the tendency toward monopoly, the idea that you've got competitive markets and competition will flourish and everyone will benefit as a result of that. But yet, the reality is, as you point out in the book, that markets tend to concentrate. In fact, you write on page 141 of the book, without effective competition, capitalism loses much or all of its justification to exist. The example I tend to bring up, at least when I try to understand it myself and when I try to discuss it with others, is I'll bring up the example of all things, a poker tournament, that you wouldn't expect a poker tournament to not result in the concentration of accumulated wealth. But yet with, and for the reason that that kind of competition kind of leads to an attrition, which results in that concentration of wealth. Yet, when the same thing happens in our real-life political economy, when rules regarding competition are also applied, the same thing happens, and then it's practically all but ignored. A question for you is this kind of simplistic model of my understanding of capitalism more or less a reflection about how it really works as far as the concentration of monopoly in the real world here and now?
Yes, it is. And I think, you know, one of the reasons we have such a problem with this, we hear all these talk about competition from politicians, from economists, from Flax. I mean, boy, you'd think, you know, the economy is just, everything's competitive about it. And there's a lot of truth. There is tremendous competition. I mean, the great mass of people in this country, we're competing like hell with each other to get jobs, to survive. We are in pitched competition for those limited number of jobs. So, yeah, it makes a lot of sense for a competitive economy. But if you look at it from the top rather than from the bottom or the middle, and look at it from, if you're at the commanding heights of the economy, you realize that for a successful corporation or capitalist, the last thing they want is competition. They love the fact that all the workers are competing for jobs. They love the fact that the suppliers they need to buy from might be competing for their business. But in their own markets, the rational thing is you don't want any competition at all. So the system logically moves to the most successful capitalists having as little direct competition as possible because it means you have less risk and more profit, and that's the whole name of the game. It's built right into the system. It's the natural undertaking. Now, what economists would argue across the political spectrum, just traditionally, is that even though that is true, there will be such an urge for profit that newcomers will always burst their way into existing profitable industries. But I don't think the evidence supports that. I think that, generally speaking, large successful firms are able to build up what are called barriers to entry and create monopolies that are pretty difficult to get rid of, you know, have generations of life in them and have immense power over the economy. So we have great competition among workers for a scarce number of jobs. We have great competition among small businesses for scraps. But at the top of the economy, we have increasing concentration, increasing monopoly profits, and increasing corruption because these large firms then basically own the government.
Kind of a quick related question on that note. I'm hard-pressed to try to come up with an example of where markets don't concentrate. Do you know of any examples off the top of your head?
I think there are certain local, you know, probably like hot dog vendors outside football games. I mean, there are certain markets where the ease of entry is so simple and the profits are so low, but they do exist, that there are going to be lots of people who can enter the markets. But I think it's very rare to find an industry that grows that you do not find concentration. It is, as I said, built right into the heart of the system.
Let's turn gears to the internet for a moment. You had actually alluded to this before, that the idea that the information superhighway, as it was long termed in the early 90s when I was going to school, that the internet, or what we now know of as the internet, will basically bring heaven on earth, because we have all this surplus of information and resources and accessibility. And how will that not, you know, improve things for the lot of humanity? In a lot of ways, it actually has been a boon and improvement, but yet there's also this kind of glassy-eyed technological optimism. I think that optimism is there as a result if you're trying to think that technology in and of itself is going to solve all your problems, and yet if you ignore, you know, hard, important questions regarding politics and economics and other things, that you're not going to do yourself a favor with regards to introducing a technology that might upend things. In fact, it actually may think worse. Is this an accurate line of thinking here?
Well, I guess I'd put it this way. I think that it's understandable that people would have a belief that technology has a magical power, because the digital revolution is mind-blowing. There's no other way around it. I mean, you know, people are walking around with mini computers in their pockets that have access to the internet, that have access to all people at all times, basically, is mind-boggling. There's no other way to put it. So, I mean, it's understandable that we would accord technology sort of superpowers to change society, because it seems to be changing society. I think where we have to be careful, though, is it doesn't have superpower to change capitalism. It doesn't have superpower to change the class structure of societies and the way institutions work. And it tends to rather be used by those structures and institutions to their own benefits. And, you know, you alluded just now in your question, Mitchell, to the 1990s. You know, when the internet came along 20 years ago, it was militantly anti-commercial. That's the only way to put it in the early 90s. You know, Mark Andreessen, the founder of Netscape, and now the Silicon Valley investor in all sorts of internet companies, put it well. He said, you know, in the late 90s, he said, we started working on the internet, referring to the early 90s. It was a militantly cooperative and egalitarian environment. It was extremely hostile to anything commercial. And that was the view, that was the genius of it originally. It was going to basically give us an end run around advertising, commercialism, all the BS of public relations and advertising that we were marinated in this sort of phony culture. That was the genius of the internet, why it was so captured the imagination of so many people initially. And what took place in the 1990s was it was turned on its head. And part of the reason it was turned on its head was because the technology is so amazing. I think what happened was that a lot of the people who were active in creating the internet, the scientists, a lot of them were hippies and countercultural people and progressives, they figured this internet is so infinite and so amazing as technology. We can let the commercial guys do what they want to do. It doesn't matter because there'll be plenty of space for everyone, and we'll eventually win in a battle place of ideas. So we don't have to worry about their monkeying in Washington. As long as there's no government censorship of websites, that's our only concern, then we will win a fair competition. We have nothing to worry about. And I think that was generated because the technologies were so radical. But I think it's also been proven that was a ludicrous position. That what has happened is that the commercial interests, through dominating the policymaking process And through getting general acceptance of the principle that whoever makes the most money should determine the outcome of the Internet, have turned the Internet into something quite the opposite of what the creators of the Internet intended three decades ago.
You also talk about in the book another kind of wonky term from social science research, but which is critical certainly not only to the points you've raised in this book and in other books, as well as in, I guess, perhaps even the future regarding media and society within the United States, what's called critical junctures. It's the idea that circumstances can change in a number of various related fields, and if the planets align, so to speak, then changes, very dramatic changes are possible. They seem to be concentrated in three different spheres, at least as I understand it. Technology, new technology arriving on the scene, a crisis regarding journalism, and a crisis regarding the political structure, probably also attendant with efforts regarding public involvement in social reform. If you have any two of these elements, you have a critical juncture. If you have all three, then you've got a rare hat trick, to borrow a term from hockey. I guess a couple of questions to you for regarding this. One is, it seems to me like we have that hat trick, that technology, journalism, and a political crisis are all currently happening now to varying levels. And second, if not, what do you think would have to happen for there to be a hat trick?
Well, you know, I think the idea of critical juncture, maybe a better way to put it for listeners than I write about in the book in sort of short term, is understand that social change does not happen in a linear fashion. It's not like at any given point in time, society can have a radical transformation. The periods in which the stars align so that ideas that were once considered unthinkable suddenly become very thinkable and even part of the conversation happen maybe once a century, twice a century, if that, depending on the country. And when you understand that, then the key thing for a scholar is to find what accounts for those moments when suddenly the range of alternatives for society becomes much greater than it had been before or would be once you solidify after a critical juncture. And in media, this is an especially important concept. It's important for all politics. It's how you look at why you have the Civil War when you have it, why you have the New Deal when you have it, why you have revolutions when you have them. But in media systems, it's very important for the reasons you gave, which is that almost all our major media are based around a specific technology. So media systems tend to be upended when there's a radical new technology, and old institutions have to be overthrown and new ones created, and creates tremendous social effects. You see this going back to the printing press, on to the telegraph, and then with film and broadcasting, and now with the Internet. And the basic argument goes like this, that you have a brief window in which society can direct the technologies and create new structures in a lot of different ways. And then it eventually ends up with one particular system, then you go to that system. And radio broadcasting is the classic example. When it came along in the 1920s, there were any number of ways that it could have developed in the United States or worldwide. The commercial model was actually probably one of the least thought of. It was not really embraced by many people. No one was really advocating it around the world. And there was debates everywhere that had radio broadcasting about how best to do it. Most countries opted for a nonprofit, non-commercial system, most democracies, a variety of different structures. The United States ended up with a commercial system, but it was after an intense fight in which there were strong efforts in the early 1930s to set up a strong non-commercial system. But once we got the commercial system put in place, the commercial interests were able to win the battle in Washington. A few years later, we forgot all about the critical juncture. It gets lost to history. And so a lot of my work has been trying to reclaim those critical junctures. And this is a long way of putting it to where we are now, which is that by the criteria of when you have major debates over media policy, this would certainly qualify. The digital revolution is nothing if not a technological revolution. Journalism is in free fall, collapse, even disintegration, which I devote a chapter of the book to talk about. So it barely exists, and what exists is deplorable. And then third, we're in a moment, really, of crisis for the broader political system. Our political governing system in this country is awash in corruption of immense standards. I mean, you really have to go back to the Gilded Age to find anything this remotely corrupt as what we now have routinized in the United States. So by all scores, we have, yeah, either a hat trick or a trifecta, pick your sports term, a triple play. But we have a situation where you would expect there to be calls for radical changes, for different alternatives to be kicked around. And it's part of the corruption of our system that we don't have that, because our political system is so entirely corrupt that the board in Washington on every major policy issue surrounding the internet and media issues is controlled and owned by the dominant firms. And they basically are fighting among themselves for a bigger slice of the pie, so to speak. But no one else is allowed at the table. And if you're not at the table, the media policy debates are going on. You're what's being served. And so we're what's being served by these guys fighting over the largest slice. And I think that's the sort of the pregnant moment we're in right now. And, you know, it's very difficult to predict the future. So we don't know where it's going to go. But this is not a stable moment because our society, the problem with the sort of corruption we have now is it's not just a hypothetical or academic concern. It shows up in a stagnant economy with declining real incomes, with collapsing public sector, the quality of life decreasing. And we have a generation of young people in this country right now in their 1920, in their age of their 20s, who've either come out of high school or college or the military, who basically have no future. Their life is grim. It's not a tenable situation. So anything could happen. We saw, for example, you know, a year or two ago, in Ohio and Wisconsin, in the Occupy movement, people out of the blue shock the pundits by suddenly protesting in massive numbers, economic inequality and corruption. And it sort of faded away, as will happen. But, you know, the problem didn't fade away. They're only getting worse. And we have to believe that people will return. So I wrote this book in anticipation that we have a lot of business to do as a free society, as a country that has aspirations to be democracy. And these problems are not going to be solved of their own volition. They're going to require popular participation, and it could get a little wild in the years to come. And when it does, it's in all our interest that we have strong, credible democratic solutions.
I guess going on to the kind of political crisis, the kind of concentration among power that you know, the public doesn't really have much of a say or seat regarding, you know, media and the internet, and the big power brokers, you could argue, and you did in the book, regarding it would seem to me telecom, so the AT&Ts, the Comcast, Verizons, the big cable cell phone companies that provide access to the internet, but also major internet companies like Amazon, Apple, Facebook, Google, Microsoft, these big players regarding it. Reading this, I have to admit, I was kind of like, I thought I knew a lot about this, and I like to think I do know a lot about this. But at the same time, I was just overwhelmed by, wow, that's a lot. And it really seems really overwhelming, even for someone like me, who's been, you know, an optimist regarding political activism and its potential for change. In the light of all of these kinds of very powerful firms who it seems like almost have a chokehold regarding it, where do you think you would see that kind of optimism regarding trying to upend this? That it's so overwhelming, it's hard to make even a dent in. So a lot of people may say, why should I bother? Well, how would you respond? Why should you bother?
Well, that's been the great issue of my whole lifetime, going back to this adulthood, going back to the early 70s. I mean, this is a recurring issue in the United States. It seems like the powers on the other side are always so great that any effort to try to change them is futile. Resistance is futile. And, you know, when you look at the internet, like you said, what we see there now is that this, what was once supposed to be a source of competition, has instead become a phenomenal source of monopoly, largely through network effects, but also through government policy. We have a handful of companies. We have, first of all, the cartel, Verizon, AT&T, and Comcast, that basically control broadband access and cell phone access in the United States. And they've divvied up the market. They're complete parasites. They serve absolutely no function that's necessary in a decent society. We can just, you know, purchase their wires and lives of them and set up a municipal system or a nonprofit system and just make it ubiquitous and be far better off for it. They're parasites, like the health insurance companies are parasites, but they own the government, so they basically are, you can't mess with AT&T, Verizon, or Comcast. And they're just monopoly companies. They're not, these companies wouldn't know a free market if it kicked them in the butt. And their specialty is owning government regulators and politicians, which they do. So they've got those guys we have to deal with. that give us much more expensive internet access and cell phone service than any other comparable country, and much lousier service than any other comparable company. It's really a crisis. On the other hand, we also have the new companies that have become the new giants in the internet world. You mentioned a bunch of them: Google, Facebook, Apple, Amazon, Microsoft, eBay. And then there's the companies behind the scenes that consumers don't see as much, like Oracle, Intel, and Qualcomm. Mm. But these are all monopolies, too. By monopoly, I mean they're monopolies in the sense that John D. Rockefeller was the monopoly of Standard Oil. John D. Rockefeller didn't sell 100% of the oil in 1885 in the United States or 1890. I think his peak he only had in the 80s. But economists never think of monopoly in terms of having selling everything in market, having 100% of the market. Rather, what they mean by monopoly is having enough of the market share that you basically can control, you have no risk, and you can control who else is in the market, and you set the price for the market. And that's what John D. Rockefeller had. It wasn't in his interest to try to drive out the last 10% of oil companies, because to do that, it would have forced him to sacrifice his own profits. So he's found just the right percentage of the market that was perfect for him. And that's how it is for Google, for Amazon, for Apple, for Microsoft. They've each got their monopoly market that is a gusher that gives them immense amounts of money and profitability, but they don't have 100% of the market, but they control the market. No one's getting rid of them. They dominate it. And we see this across the board online. This is what's happening. We're having these huge companies that rule the economy. They're central to capitalism. It's one of the reasons why I say the book's about capitalism. And they dominate governance. It's why we will never have privacy protection in this country, because all the money is made by Google and Facebook right now, and by all these other companies, by surreptitious spying in everything we do. And as a result, you know, all hot air and propaganda and rhetoric and public relations aside, we're never going to have legitimate privacy protection online, because the business model is predicated on there being no privacy, rhetoric notwithstanding. So it seems, that's a long prolegomenon or whatever to answer your question. So it seems, yeah, these guys, these giants, King Kong and Godzilla on steroids, how can we possibly, as mosquitoes, do battle with them? And I would say that, you know, the fact of the matter is that every single issue I talk about in the book, and I list, you know, privacy, monopoly power, journalism, media ownership, copyright, when you get right down to it, network neutrality, community broadband, there's a number of these issues. And every single one of them, when people hear about these issues, they tend to be against the corporate interests. And the more they know about the issue, the more they're against it. I mean, so basically we've got the numbers on our side. And we've got passion on our side when people learn about the issues, which isn't always that easy. And I like that. I like the fact that we've got the people on our side. It hasn't always been that way. I remember in the 80s, I didn't always feel like I had the people on my side. I thought I was definitely a minority on a lot of issues. I don't feel that way on any of these issues, and on most issues anymore. The great crisis of our times is that we have a political system and an economic system that serves minority interests and does not have the people on its side. And this is the great tension we're seeing. And that also points out our challenge. We just have to educate people, organize people, and get people active, and we can actually win stuff. And it's amazing how quickly social change can happen when you get people active. I don't mean to dwell on things like Arab Spring, because that's almost been beaten into the ground, but it's got to be pointed out that, you know, 1 week before the demonstrations in Tahrir Square, every smart person in America was saying the Egyptian regime was there forever. The idea that it could be challenged was unthinkable, because it was, you know, it was solvent, it was stable, there was no credible opposition that anyone knew about. And a month later, Mubarak was out of a job. And, you know, their history is filled with examples of these, even recent history, where something looks impossible to change, and then suddenly you're in the midst of a critical juncture, a crisis, and it's like, wow, why didn't anyone see this coming? This seems so overdue. And I think that's the sort of period we're in right now in this country.
And that's certainly a cause for optimism. I'd like to talk a little bit about one of the chapters we've kind of touched on it in this discussion so far regarding journalism and the disillusion of what's termed old media. Examples about this are now rampant. You've got newspapers are shuttering left and right. So you've got this kind of shrinking and disillusion, or some shakeup at the very least, regarding these old institutions. And a lot of people may say, okay, great, out with the old, in with the new. But yet at the same time, especially with regards to journalism, a lot of the news that people kind of regard as news of what's going on is kind of sourced from these, you know, the big newspapers and the big media institutions. And so I guess my question to you is that maybe people shouldn't be celebrating this, maybe not 100%, that at the same time, while there certainly a lot of criticism may be accorded regarding these big institutions, regarding, you know, their biases and their problems, but at the same time, you still want to learn something about the world, and if these institutions go away, you might not be able to do that as easily or as well. Will there the dissolution or this changeover lead to the reduction of news?
Well, you packed a lot into that question, Mitchell. And you know, I wrote a long chapter on this called "Journalism Is Dead: Long Live Journalism?" And I've written a book about this with my friend John Nichols called The Death and Life of American Journalism that came out a couple of years ago. It's a passion of mine. I've been writing and studying the political economy of journalism for decades. And, you know, I think, you know, on one hand, I understand the position. Well, look, journalism in the olden days sucked. You know, it gave us wars and it did a terrible job in America. It had all sorts of weaknesses. So the fact that it's going out of business and being replaced by the internet can only be good. It certainly couldn't be bad. And I think that's something there's a problem with that. And the problem is that we're seeing the end of resources going to journalism. There are probably about 40% of the resources going to journalism today in terms of labor and money being spent than there were on a per capita basis than there were, say, two decades ago, if that. And it's falling rapidly because the commercial basis of journalism is dying. There is not a commercial basis for journalism. It's no longer a profitable undertaking. And the reason is that journalism has never been a profitable undertaking. Popular journalism for a mass audience of independent reporting has never been a very strong, commercially lucrative undertaking. For the first, it's a public good. It's something society desperately needs, but that the market will not provide sufficient quality or quantity. And in American history, the way we solved that problem for the first 100 years of American history was through government subsidies, printing and postal, that spawned a huge press far beyond that found in any other nation. It was central to the best parts of American democracy in the 19th century. In the 20th century, those subsidies decreased to newspapers, but the way journalism was subsidized and why it gave the illusion of being commercially viable was that advertising provided between 50 and 100% of the revenues. Final readers never provided anywhere near a majority of the revenues, or viewers or users. And advertising gave the illusion that journalism could be commercially viable. But now advertising's left journalism. It's in the process of leaving. It's all but gone. And as it goes to the internet, advertising has no connection to journalism whatsoever. And in fact, advertising has no connection to any media content sites whatsoever. Advertisers don't support media online. They basically go through networks and they buy their target audience, whatever website they go to. It could be the Best Buy website that you find the women 18 to 24 you want, but they have to be the news media website. So as a result, there is no commercially based journalism left. The commercial system is dead and dying, and it's not coming back. And the hedge fund people who are investing in our media understand that. The price of media have plummeted. Online, offline, any line, doesn't matter. We do not have commercial journalism in this country that's popular based that the markets can give us. It is an existential crisis for our society. Now, this point is missed by a lot of people online for understandable reasons. If you're like me, you have like 20 websites you go to. It seems like you're in a blizzard of information. There's stuff everywhere you turn. You do a Google search on Kentucky, and there's 5 trillion pages on Kentucky. There's probably 3 million news hits on Kentucky if you enter that. But it's not journalism. I mean, it's not original journalism that's being covering anything. There's no one getting paid. There's no one accountable for it. There's no copy editor. There's no proofreaders. There's no fact checkers. There's not independent competitive people. So if someone misses a story, that someone else is going to get it and force everyone to get in line and start covering something. All that is decreasing. It's disappearing. And I argue in the book, if we're going to have journalism, and it's an if that better become we are going to have journalism or else we aren't having self-government at all, it's going to require a public policy solution like we had in the first 100 years, some sort of subsidy so we have the resources to do independent competitive journalism, but a subsidy that doesn't allow government interference or control. over the content. I think it's a solvable problem, but it's one that we've got to face up to and embrace, or else it won't get solved.
Kind of dovetailing along these lines, I'd like to mention one kind of a topic that isn't mentioned in the book, but it's kind of recent vintage and interest, especially to a lot of Chicagoans. The Koch Industries, Koch Brothers, big oil baron billionaires, there's been a report in old media in the New York Times that broke the news that they're interested in buying the Tribune's newspapers. At the same time, on one aspect, I can understand why they want to do this, especially where in the most recent 2012 political elections, most of the money, and certainly I would imagine the Koch brothers poured a lot of money into buying ads. In fact, actually, I remember reading an article you co-wrote, 80% of all the money that's used in raised by politicians goes to buy TV ads. But yet, if it turns out that, as we may see, and some people may suggest, that may be less of an effective purchase has been seen before. Some wealthy people may say, why bother? I could just buy my own media and get my own influence that way. Yet that kind of dovetails with this kind of crisis of journalism itself, that maybe it might not be that, old industries might not want to buy old media because they may not be getting that kind of bang for their buck. And so my question to you is, do you think the Koch brothers are making a smart move in trying to buy the Tribune Company, or are they just, dinosaurs just buying up other dinosaurs and they're all going to die soon?
Well, let's get away from this old media term. That's a bogus term. That term should be thrown away with your, Betamax and your 8-track. Old media don't exist. Most people consume the New York Times and Chicago Tribune online. These are as new media as salon.com or moveon.org. So old media is a bogus term. When the Koch brothers are buying the Chicago Tribune, it's not old media they care about. It's just political influence. And so once we understand that, they're not buying old media, they're buying media. What they're doing is they're saying, hey, instead of spending, or in addition to spending $400 or $500 million to run ads to support candidates we like and attack candidates we don't like, instead of doing that, why don't we just take some money to gobble up what remains of monopoly newspapers in cities like Chicago and Los Angeles and Baltimore, and then we can control those newsrooms? Is that a smart thing for them to do? Absolutely. If I was a Koch brother, if I was another Koch brother, and I was shared their political views and their desires, I'd be racing to buy these. I mean, the prices of these newspapers has plummeted. The Philadelphia Inquirer sold last year for 10% of what it sold for just 6 years earlier. I mean, these prices are rock bottom because there's no commercial reason to do newspaper publishing or to do journalism, not just newspaper publishing, journalism. No rational investor would do that to return a profit, at least unless you're spending very little amount of money, like 10% of what it was worth 5 years ago. So for the Koch brothers to go ahead and gobble up these papers at basically a song and then still have the credibility of a newsroom to put out, news coverage of politics, and you can pick the editors and the reporters, oh, lordy, that's a brilliant move. It's absolutely great. And then there'll be people offering jobs to pay so they can get reporters eating out of their hands. Oh, it's a strikingly brilliant move if they can pull it off. And it's disastrous for us. But it really takes us back to where journalism was 100 years ago in this country, when you only had press barons who used their control of the press to push their agenda. But the only problem is that was a vibrant system by comparison. That was a system where there still were, people had our voices. We had it wasn't so closed down. This would be a system where the only newsrooms would be owned by these guys like the Koch brothers. Now, it's bad news, and we've already seen this. This is not a new thing. There's been a number of billionaires who've gobbled up papers for this reason. Out in San Diego, the Daily newspaper was purchased by some guy who was in Manchester, I think his name is, some billionaire guy with strong right-wing politics. And he's used his control over the San Diego paper, which is now basically a web paper, largely. He's used that to push his immediate political agenda, which is hard right, and to great effect. And I think the Koch brothers probably look at that and say, hey, why can't we play that game?
This past week, the Obama administration had formally announced the former telecom lobbyist, a gentleman named Tom Wheeler, as its nominee to be the new head of the Federal Communications Commission. My question to you regarding Tom Wheeler, do you think that his involvement where, especially where a lot of kind of an insider baseball question, a lot of people who've kind of aligned themselves with media democracy efforts have kind of given their support with regards to Tom Wheeler. But a lot of people have said, wait a minute, the guy's a lobbyist. You can't trust those guys. What are your thoughts with regards to Tom Wheeler? Do you think that his involvement is going to improve or reduce our chances regarding this kind of critical juncture that we're facing in the next few years during what could be a Wheeler administration at the FCC?
I think the appointment of Tom Wheeler to be the head of the FCC, what the episode tells us immediately is just how little the media reform movement has accomplished that I'm part of, so I take the blame here, and how far we still have to go. Here we are, that we started the modern contemporary media reform movement about a decade ago around media ownership issues. We've had six major conferences. We have a group like Free Press, which I helped start, with hundreds of thousands of members and 30 or 40 organizers. And, you know, the premise of Free Press and the premise of the modern media reform movement was that we had to get outside the Beltway and expand the range of debate beyond the usual corporate debate that dominated in Washington in the 70s, 80s, 90s, and into the zeros. And, you know, we had a lot of success. We've won a number of victories. I'm really proud of what Free Press and the media reform movement has done in a lot of areas. But we've also become part of the system. And I think it's striking that when Tom Wheeler was announced by President Obama as his appointee to the FCC, that virtually the entire media reform movement was either enthusiastic about Tom Wheeler in some cases, or they were sort of cautiously hopeful, like Free Press was. You know, they're critical in a way, but at the same time not wanting to burn any bridges because you want to be in good terms with him. And it left, it was absurd even that the New Yorker, John Cassidy, their writer, and the New York Times in its editorial this last week, both were very critical of the Wheeler appointment, because here's a guy who's basically pure lobby. He was a lobbyist for these big industries. He was a bundler of money to raise hundreds of thousands, millions of dollars for the Obama campaigns in 2008, 2012. Complete corporate insider dude. Supposed to be running an agency when Obama got elected in 2008 on the premise that you don't put people like this to run regulatory agencies. That violates the public trust. And the fact that the media reform movement more or less signed off on this. It felt powerless to challenge it and sort of had to embrace it so that Tom Wheeler would answer their phone calls when they approached him to get crumbs thrown at them. It tells us how far we have to go and how much work we have to do. That the Democratic Party is an abject failure on media reform issues. They have a wonderful spine and great rhetoric, and they're out of power. But in power, they've been really not that different on most of the core issues from what we've got from Republicans. Some difference, but for the most part, not that much. We've got to, I think, this, what this points to is that the media reform movement needs to get outside the Beltway again and regroup, organize, marshal the troops, come in and really try to blow the thing up, because right now the game is still being, the rules of the game are being written by AT&T and the big guys and their representatives, and the public really has no meaningful role to play still.
And I guess my last question on kind of tying all of this up, that over the last decade, and I've kind of been involved in this certainly with my own efforts regarding media and policy and so forth, that, yeah, we've got some fights that we've won, and I think that's a good thing. And I'm wondering, though, if there's a silver lining about all of this, could the lessons that we've used in organizing and winning those fights be brought to kind of like fighting the fights that we're now facing regarding this critical juncture, as it's termed? My thinking is that a lot of times we're kind of aligned in like one or another pigeonholed option regarding, are you for or against media concentration? Are you for or against net neutrality? And yet, okay, yeah, I can click a checkbox to choose one or another option. But at the same time, we're in a critical juncture. I want to write the options before just having to choose them. And I want to have to choose whatever options I have. Do you think that the activism that we've had in the last decade and whatever wins we've been able to achieve can help to allow people to write their own options, so to speak? Or
I do. I think that's where we have to go. I think you and I are on the same page, Mitchell. I think what we need to do is, you know, the range of debate in Washington is so pathetic. It's so scripted by, you know, the battle between Comcast and AT&T. It becomes then the only battle we're allowed to have. That we don't we have no reason for people in the general public to give a darn because they seem like it's meaningless fights in the big scheme of things. I think what the movement desperately needs in the next stage has got to be is we need to come up with bold proposals that are completely considered outlandish by Barack Obama and Mitch McConnell and everyone in Washington and at the FCC to be considered outrageous, but which make perfect sense to everyone else in America. We've got to organize on bold ideas that really get people's imagination that would fundamentally change things for the better, rally the troops, then go in and raise hell and force people in Washington to pay attention by whatever means we have to use. Things like get rid of the cartel. Why do we have AT&T, Verizon ripping us off for thousands of dollars a year for their monopoly service and giving us crappy product? They don't deserve it. They only get this money because they own the government. They aren't doing anything to deserve it. Why do we even allow TV political ads? They're bogus. No one likes them except the media companies that own the board in Washington. These are the sort of things I know from experience. The American people get really fired up. Okay, I could really live in a world without political ads and more for candidate debates. That's good. I could live without paying $150 for internet and cell phone access a month for crappy service when someone in Sweden is paying $25 for twice as good service. Why can't we have that situation? I think we have to capture people's imagination with bold ideas, the sort of ideas that would make Tom Wheeler reach for the barf bag if he heard them, or Barack Obama, but that make the American people think this is where this country ought to be going.
That was Robert McChesney, who was interviewed on May 12th. The book, Digital Disconnect, is available from the publisher, The New Press, online at thenewpress.com. That concludes this episode of From the Trenches. If you'd like to learn more and get involved in making media, including how to help make this radio program, please visit the website of the Chicago Independent Media Center at chicago.indymedia.org or call 773-384-8544. I'm Bree Hayden. Thank you for listening, and please join us again for another episode From the Trenches.